Just a handful of companies produce nearly all of the meat now consumed in the United States, and according to Christopher Leonard, Tyson Foods is king among them. In his book, The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business, Mr. Leonard explains how, over the last 50 years, Tyson created the blueprint for modern production of chicken and pork, controlling how the animals are raised, what they eat, and how they're slaughtered, all while reaping massive profits and remaining almost entirely opaque to the consumer. He was here in March, and we received a strong response from our listeners, so we are re-airing that conversation for you today. I began by pointing out that I had mentioned chicken and pork in my introduction because Tyson is a major player in both of those industries, and I asked, but hasn't the company been working hard in recent years to also bring the beef industry under its control?
Absolutely. You know, people, because these companies are so hidden, really, in rural America, and they don't engage the consumer directly. Most of their products are unbranded. A lot of people aren't familiar just with the reach of a company like Tyson, but it is one of the nation's biggest beef producers as well.
But is raising cattle, isn't it very different from raising chickens or even hogs?
It is very different. The big meat packers have never been able to crack the code of raising cattle in the kind of factory farms that they can raise chicken and hogs in. That's due to a lot of reasons. The biology of the cow has just been difficult to shoehorn into that. But the way they've gained control over the cattle market is a little different. They've locked up the quote-unquote buyer side, if you will. As you mentioned, just four companies buy 85% of all the cattle in the United States and slaughter it and turn it into beef. So what that means is you'll have these cattle going into a funnel, if you will. They go from ranches to then giant feedlots and then into the slaughterhouses of just four companies. So these companies can almost dictate the price. They don't compete vigorously.
What happens to the few beef producers who want to remain independent? Do they have their own slaughterhouses, or do they have to go to the same ones that the others go to?
They have to go to the same ones the other go to. I mean, we're in the era of the mega slaughterhouse. There are virtually no small independent slaughterhouses anymore.
You've explained that vertical integration is at the core of Tyson's strategy. What's vertical integration?
That refers to when a company purchases all the means of production. It would be as if, you know, Apple made its own microchips for the iPad. In the case of poultry production, what it means is that Tyson Foods, one company, will own all the things that used to be independent businesses in America. It owns the feed mill, it owns the slaughterhouse, it owns the hatchery, it owns the trucking line, everything tightly controlled from the central office.
And the food processing plant as well.
Yeah.
How long did it take for Tyson's competitors to begin copying their way of doing business?
Well, Tyson really pioneered this back in the 40s in the Deep South, and there were other companies doing this as well. But Tyson just became the largest and most successful of them.
And how much of the poultry industry does Tyson control?
Tyson controls about 22% of the national chicken market.
Well, most of the chicken in New York City supermarkets, at least the ones that are labeled, seem to come from Purdue. Is Purdue one of Tyson's major competitors?
Well, it is, but it's very telling. Tyson controls about 22% of the market, and then its other big competitor, Pilgrim's Pride, controls a similar amount. Together, those two firms alone control 40% of the market, which is unprecedented in U.S. history. Purdue, running third, only controls 7% of the market, so there's a big gap.
But they put their name on the product, and as you said earlier, Tyson doesn't always do that. So when I go to my local supermarket and I see a chicken that's just been wrapped up with a label telling the weight and the price, is it likely that that's a Tyson chicken?
Yes, and if it's not, it's one of the other big three produced in just almost the exact model that Tyson uses as well.
Isn't much of the meat that Tyson produces meat that becomes supermarket rotisserie chickens or is served in cafeterias and restaurants also never identified? Didn't they invent chicken nuggets?
Actually, I think some food scientists working with McDonald's invented the McNugget, but Tyson had been pressuring McDonald's for years to sell chicken and took that idea and ran with it and was the first company to really produce it on a mass scale.
So do you have any sense of what percentage of the meat Tyson produces goes to supermarkets and or butchers, and what percentage goes to fast food chains and other restaurants?
It's a large portion, and I don't have the exact breakdown of the number for today. But, you know, the branded Tyson products we buy are really just the tip of the iceberg. This is the company that makes meat that we eat, as you said, at restaurants, nursing homes, cafeterias.
And they also sell some prepared foods, don't they?
Sure, yeah.
You can get breaded chickens and things like that with the Tyson label on them.
Exactly.
What about other brands like Farmland, Murray's, D'Artagnan? Are they all produced totally independently?
It's a mix. We've seen a wave of consolidation in this business in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Really happened under the public's radar. And what that means is that a company like Tyson will have dozens of brand names that it owns. The same with Smithfield Foods is another example. As they bought up their competitors, they kept that brand. So you can see a rainbow of brands in the grocery store, but they trace back to just a few companies.
Should I assume that a chicken that's labeled organic or raised without antibiotics is not a Tyson chicken?
No. For example, companies like Tyson can call chicken antibiotic-free by feeding that bird antibiotic-like drugs that produce the same effect, for example. It's really one of the things that's troublesome for consumers. It's almost a buyer beware type environment. If you really want to know how your chicken is produced, it requires a lot of research on your side. That's why more people are buying from local producers who they can visit the farm and know exactly how that meat is produced.
If you have a farmer's market near you and the chicken is sold there, but that isn't always the case. And if you go into a butcher shop and say, is this a Tyson chicken, are they likely to tell you?
You know, they might not even know at that level. And you're exactly right. It's not a feasible option for most families to go to the time and expense to buy locally. And I think that's why this industry, as it's structured now, deserves so much scrutiny.
My guest is Christopher Leonard. His book, The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business, is published by Simon & Schuster. It's Simon & Schuster, right?
That's right.
Didn't the development of factory farming and the increase in efficiency it brought by raising animals result in lower meat prices?
No question about it. It's a fascinating story. As we industrialized the meat system in the 60s and 70s, the inflation-adjusted cost of meat came down. We got real gains from making it in a factory-like environment. But what's important to understand is that just because we industrialized the system doesn't mean we have to hand it over, the control of it, to a few companies, which is what has happened.
Well, Tyson and companies like it increased the amount of meat available to consumers during the 60s and 70s. But hasn't the situation changed in recent years? Hasn't the price of meat been going up?
It really has. It's been going up sharply, as a matter of fact, in recent years.
Is it because of lack of competition?
I think that is a huge component of it, and it just cannot be ignored. There's tremendous evidence that a lack of competition plays into that. I can give you one quick concrete example. In the book, I walk through how Tyson Foods is able to cut chicken supplies when profits are bad because it controls so much of the market, and then prices will again rise. Poultry companies of the past did not have the market reach to do that.
So they just hold back on chickens?
Well, that's right. Tyson has a network of about 4,000 chicken farms across rural America. With one command from a central office, it can cut back production on those farms. It can cut the number of chicks it places on those farms. And it has levers of control that companies couldn't have dreamed of decades ago.
Well, that raises the price of chicken for them, but what does it do to the farmers?
It puts the squeeze on the farmers. There's no question about it. It means the farmer has less income because they're raising fewer chickens.
Well, it would seem that what's happened in the meat industry would have violated antitrust laws. Weren't antitrust laws used in the early 1900s to break up a group of companies known as the Meat Trust that monopolized the market and raised the prices that consumers had to pay while they depressed the amounts that they paid farmers? Sounds like the same situation as today.
That's what's so stunning. We faced this problem 100 years ago. We solved the problem. You know, by the 1960s, we had a vigorous, competitive meat industry that was transparent. It was prosperous for farmers, but we sort of forgot the lessons of the past, let it consolidate it again, and now we're almost back where we started.
When Barack Obama took office, wasn't one of his goals, stated goals anyway, to revive the rural economy? What happened?
Well, he began with a really ambitious reform agenda on this, appointed some very serious reformers, and USDA proposed sweeping antitrust reforms, but faced a very concerted fight from the meat industry lobbyists who really dismantled the effort and basically killed it.
In his glowing review of your book in last Sunday's New York Times Book Review, Nick Reading wrote that what distinguishes your book from others about food in America is that it tells a story from inside the walls of Big Food itself, from the meeting rooms to the mega barns, rather than from the safer move of the outsider. Were you able to do much of that research because for 10 years you were the national agribusiness reporter for the Associated Press?
I think that really helped. And as with all of these things, being a reporter is just a game of dogged persistence. You call 10 people, 6 hang up, 4 talk to you, and one of them's a great interview.
Well, despite its secrecy, its policy of secrecy, you spoke to the head of Tyson.
That's right. I was very fortunate to interview Don Tyson before he passed away in 2011. He's a brilliant, brilliant man, and I felt that he was sort of proud of what he'd done with his life. He doesn't care about public relations, and he was happy to talk.
But was he aware of the kinds of problems that his business model causes a lot of people?
You know, I interviewed him twice at length on record, and he certainly was proud of the company he built, and I think he was removed from some of the on-the-ground realities that were lower down.
Well, Tyson's is a publicly traded company, but it has been able to keep a very low profile. It's almost been secretive. I mean, you could call it secretive, couldn't you?
Oh, sure. There's a code of silence among the managers. It's very hard to get people to talk.
Where is the company located?
So the company is located in Springdale, Arkansas, but it's really anchored in rural America. That's where the giant meat plants and feedlots are, in tiny towns like Waldron, Arkansas, and other places.
You also mentioned Berryville, Arkansas, Dexter, mm-hmm. Mississippi, Broken Bow, Oklahoma. I'm assuming labor is cheaper there as well.
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the reasons why the poultry industry grew so huge in the South.
In depressed rural cities like Waldron, Arkansas, isn't Tyson's often the town's main reason for even existing?
Absolutely. If the Tyson plant was to close up in these towns, the town would cease to exist.
And what does that mean? Has that led people in those towns to be kind of unwilling to talk about their experience?
There's a mix. I mean, you really have to work at it to get people to talk. But there's no question that when a company has a local monopoly like that, it just has tremendous power. People are afraid to talk about it, afraid to criticize it. And it's hard to get people to open up.
You did speak with some residents of Tyson-dominated communities in the South and the Midwest. What impact did they tell you that Tyson's taking over the locally owned businesses like the feedlots, the hatcheries, the slaughterhouses have had on the people who live and work in those communities?
Well, in a lot of towns, it's just like asking about the weather. It's something that's so taken for granted as the background way of existence that people oftentimes don't really scrutinize how things are working. But, you know, the people who haven't been totally taken over, there's just this feeling of being embattled and feeling this new thing encroaching upon them.
Well, the only thing that, as we pointed out, that Tyson doesn't do is actually farm mm-hmm. the animals. It pays local farmers to raise chickens or pigs for the company. But they're required to follow a strict set of company-mandated guidelines, aren't they?
Oh, sure. I mean, hog farms, for example, run by Smithfield, there's a literal checklist on the wall you have to follow. And the same is true for many chicken farms as well.
And there's a thing that at Tyson called a tournament system. What's that?
Yeah, and as quick background, the terms of these contracts for farmers got worse and worse over the decades as competition dwindled and there's less choice of people for the farmers to work with. So this tournament, I thought farmers would get paid based on how much meat they raised. But instead, Tyson will get a pool of farmers, rank them against each other, and then pay the top half a bonus and the bottom half, it'll take away their pay to the point where they might go out of business. What's so fundamentally unfair about that tournament is, first of all, the farmer has no control over the main criteria for success, the health of the chicken and the feed. But second of all, it's a zero-sum game. So even if all the farmers do great and beat the industry benchmarks, the top half will take money from the bottom half.
Well, if they're feeding the chickens the cheapest thing they can, doesn't that affect the taste?
I have seldom have people walk up to me and remark that chicken tastes much better today than it tasted 10 years ago. And with a system like this, these companies, even down to the genetics of the animal, they're aiming for that low middle quality range of just consistent high volume product.
Now, the governor of Idaho recently signed a law that criminalizes hidden cameras recording inside farm facilities, the ag gag law, which Actually, is in a number of states, isn't it?
Yes. And, you know, I don't do hidden camera work, by the way. I'm a straight-up old-school reporter. I always identify myself. These laws are really troubling and just seem on their face to be against the First Amendment of the Constitution. You can't make documenting reality illegal in the U.S.
But the reason that they don't want people to see it is because the conditions in these farms are so horrific that the chickens are all jammed together. Don't they break their legs in some cases? Or is it the pigs? Pigs are really squashed together. They're animals that like to roam around.
And pigs, when you see these undercover videos, pigs are often the most disturbing. They're large animals. They're intelligent. They're smart. And, yeah, the business model has created conditions that are very detrimental to the animals sometimes.
Were you allowed to get into any of the processing plants?
Yeah, you bet. I've toured hog slaughterhouses, chicken slaughterhouses, and been through it.
And what are they like?
I kind of describe it like Willy Wonka's chocolate factory from hell. It's a giant, mechanized, highly sophisticated operation where chickens come in one end, they're dismantled along a disassembly line, spun into different rows, and then cooked, and nuggets come out the other end. It's amazing.
So, and they rely often on immigrant workers.
Absolutely.
Illegals? What were we? Non-documented workers? So what happens if the government wants to look for some people who are undocumented? Do they just organize a raid on one of these places?
That has been happening in the past. And in fact, I think it's been happening a lot more. It's just been an open secret during the 90s, particularly when this industry really got up and running, that the immigration laws were not being enforced and that the company really relied on immigrant labor that was often undocumented.
Although it is interesting that some of the states that these companies are in are the same states that are calling for tougher immigration laws.
That's right. Again, it was there was a huge wave of change in the 90s. I mean, I was in small towns in Missouri at the time reporting on massive changes. I mean, the demographic makeup of a town would change overnight. And mostly, by and large, it went okay in these towns. I did not see a lot of tensions. But by the same time, now, you know, when the economy goes south, you see tensions between groups of people. And so I think that's one of the reasons why you kind of see that movement in some of these states.
My guest is Christopher Leonard, former national agribusiness reporter for the Associated Press. He's also written for Fortune, Slate, New York Times, and other publications. And he has written a book called The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business. It is published by Simon & Schuster. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with a conversation I had this March with Christopher Leonard about his book, The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business. And we are re-airing a few today as we begin this long holiday weekend. I started off the second part of our talk by asking about something he had mentioned earlier. What happens to the farmers if the birds get sick and die, or if they fail to gain the right amount of weight while they're in the farmer's care? I wondered, are the farmers being forced to shoulder all the financial risk if anything goes wrong?
Yes, they are. That's one of the fundamental elements of this contract system. The volatility of that is pushed down to the farm level.
And they have no bargaining power?
None. I mean, these companies operate as virtual monopolies. And again, when these farmers, when the business really started back in the 70s, farmers might have a long-term contract. Now these contracts can be flock to flock.
Well, if a farmer isn't happy with what Tyson or the others will pay, can they go somewhere else?
Often, no. A company like Tyson will, because they bought up all their competitors, they operate as local monopolies. So it's not like a farmer can just go to another company. And, you know, in a good scenario, a farmer might have two big poultry companies to choose from, or maybe three. But with such little competition, that's not a real choice.
And you say that the farmers who raise animals for Tyson live like modern-day sharecroppers?
You know, it's the reality on the ground that I've found. They're heavily indebted. They're dependent on this company for their livelihood, powerless under the way the contracts are set up, and really live on the edge of poverty. I interviewed one couple with a $2 million farm that literally could not afford health insurance.
This is the Yandells?
That would be the Yangs, actually. Oh. The Yandells did go out of business because of this.
They Jerry Yandell had spent his entire life raising chickens, and he told you that he went bankrupt and lost his farm while he was working for Tyson. What happened?
His story was really what led me off on this book in 2004. I mean, Jerry, like you said, had been raising chickens for 20 years. It only took three bad flocks of sick chickens to drive this guy out of business. He and his wife had built a middle-class life, and it was destroyed in a few months.
And you calculated that he was earning $5 an hour?
Yeah. Depending on how you rank in the tournament, you might earn nothing for 6 weeks of work.
Now, I would assume if there was illness in his flock, there was illness in the flocks of nearby other farmers nearby. Did they all experience similar problems?
Many of them did. I was down reporting on it at the time, and they really couldn't get any answers out of the company.
So when they're forced out of business, who takes over the farm?
Well, in the case of this town, many of the farms were sold to immigrants, Laotian immigrants who were coming down from Minnesota and who heard about this sort of setup of chicken farming, and it was pitched to them as being a really good deal.
It's widely accepted today by the public that farming is a hardscrabble business defined by thin profits and economic volatility, but you write that that's not always true. Are you saying that agriculture can be much more profitable than most Americans think it is?
You bet. I've been covering agribusiness for over a decade. You know, there's a ton of money in this business. Tyson Foods reported almost $800 million in pure profit last year. And you go to a lot of these farms. Let's look at grain farmers. They own semi-trucks, giant barns. I mean, there's a lot of money in this business.
Well, it's interesting that they are a multi-billion dollar business considering how they started.
Right. They started in the living room of a guy named John Tyson back in 1930 in Springdale, Arkansas, in really poor conditions.
This is because the family had lost everything in the crash?
That's right. John Tyson was a young man with a one-year-old son. He kind of got kicked off the family farm during the Depression and had to start over.
And then he began transporting chickens and then realized that he could make more money and cut down on delays if he was slaughtering them and then he was transporting them?
Yeah, almost built this vertically integrated system on an ad hoc basis, piece by piece, just realizing he could make more money if he mixed the feed and then added the feed mill, et cetera.
And then his son, Don, the man you interviewed, began working in the business when he was just 10 years old. But he seems to be a natural businessman.
Incredible mind for business, not just because he was raised in it. But this is a guy who ran a regional poultry firm in the South in the 60s. By the time he passed away, he'd built the world's biggest meat company. He had a mind that was capable of growing to huge proportions along with the business.
Because he was willing to take risks.
Took huge risks, but was also very, very canny in how he took those risks. Very good at doing it.
And a charismatic character, you say.
He would walk along the lines in these slaughterhouses and people would just light up when he saw them. He had that kind of politician's natural touch. People really, really were loyal to this guy and wanted to work for him.
And when he died, Bill Clinton delivered the eulogy.
Delivered the eulogy. Remarked at what a great friend Don Tyson was and how they'd known each other for decades going back to Fayetteville, where Bill Clinton got his start politically.
Now, for many years, Don Tyson's main focus was chickens.
Mm-hmm.
When did he first start exploring the idea of adding pigs to the list?
The early 1970s. They started experimenting with this in different ways.
Now, that's a long time ago. Many people Ruth Reichel used to be a regular visitor to our show, and she lamented the change in pork from something that had a lot of flavor and often had some fat in it to this very lean, relatively tasteless meat that is the norm today.
Mm-hmm.
Can we blame this on Don Tyson?
He worked there were others doing it as well, like Murphy Family Farms, Smithfield Family Farms. But once again, you see Tyson Foods on the cutting edge of this transformation.
And the company's hog raising protocols were developed by trial and error.
That's right. Experiments on secret farms. I interviewed some of the people that ran these. They were trying to figure out how you could jam hogs into basically a big chicken house and raise them shoulder to shoulder in the same factory environment that they were doing chickens at the time. Eventually, they cracked that code, and the modern-day factory hog farm was born.
But aren't pigs resistant to being jammed together?
You bet. It's not an easy thing to pull off. Hogs are larger than humans. They produce a lot of waste. They get sick. We've had to make a lot of adjustments to the business model to make this work, such as confining mother hogs in these gestation crates where they can't move, giving them massive doses of antibiotics so they don't get sick. There's a lot that it has to happen to make this work.
And then they have to deal with the manure, don't they?
Yes, in these conditions.
It creates a lot of methane?
That's right. You know, hog manure can be a fertilizer for fields, but when you get too many hogs in one place, they would just sort of steer the waste into a giant lagoon that was toxic.
The cover story of the current issue of On Earth, the Natural Resources Defense Council's magazine, focuses on complaints that the large volume of manure being produced by pigs in factory farms in Iowa, which is not for Tyson, but for Hormel, is poisoning the area water supply.
That's right. This literally becomes factory pollution. And again, this is an absolute consequence of the industrialization of the hog business. I really do call it an audacious corporate takeover that nobody's heard of.
We will be talking to the author of that article, Ted Genoways, tomorrow on our show.
Great.
Listeners have been writing in to find out about things that obviously they're curious about. For example, I did mention Bell & Evans when I was talking about some of the other brands. They seem to work with PETA. Are they in the Tyson chain?
Not that I'm aware of, but I have not looked closely into that company or brand.
And then other people are wondering about kosher chickens. Are they any better?
You know, I hear that a lot, and I've not also scrutinized the kosher market a lot, but I know that you have very similar production methods, but I don't know exactly how they change it.
And then there are all these confusions over what organic really means.
Mm-hmm.
When I read organic on a label, should I immediately assume that also means free range?
Absolutely not. No, not at all. You can raise animals under so-called organic standards, but have most of the production system look identical to traditional.
One of the things you report that I found fascinating is that the pork industry underwent a major transformation in just 2 years after Tyson figured out how to tweak the factory farm model to raise pigs.
The revolution really happened in the 1990s. We lost 90% of the hog farms in the United States because well-funded companies like Tyson were building out this network of contract factory hog barns, and that really suffocated the cash market. So independent people were driven out of business just because they weren't working under contract with one of these big firms.
Is this also attracting immigrant farmers?
I have not seen that as much. I toured mostly in Iowa, and it's fascinating. The terms of contracts for hog farmers are often better than those for chicken farmers, and I think that's because there is still a little bit more competition in the hog market. But once that dwindles, you could expect they'll see the exact same thing happen that happened to the chicken farmers.
And now, as you said, we're going to start seeing it with beef cattle as well?
That's right. Now that the companies have locked up the slaughterhouse doors, basically, and control all of that, they're starting to put these feedlots under contract, and that can extend all the way to the ranch level. So you're seeing a lot more of that.
But you write that the cattle industry has held out so far against vertical integration.
I interviewed some really fascinating people like Gene Carson, this real literal cowboy who runs a feedlot in Dodge City, Kansas. But what's happening is, as the contracts increase, the cash market is dwindling, and these people are having fewer and fewer options to sell into. So they're almost being forced into the integrated system promoted by Tyson Foods and the handful of competitors it has.
And does this mean that we're going to start seeing cows all jammed into pens the way we're now seeing pigs?
Well, at the end of their life, cattle live on feedlots that can be highly concentrated, but I do not think we're ever going to see factory cattle barns, so to speak, from the very, you know, time they're a calf.
Well, I know that a lot of the comments on our show page are going to be from vegetarians who are saying, told you so.
Mm-hmm.
But is there any way that people can express their unhappiness with the situation without necessarily becoming vegetarian?
Well, you bet. And I'm not vegetarian. I think meat, and I don't mean to offend anybody, but I do think meat is an important source of protein for folks on a budget like myself. There are two things. I mean, first of all, if you're really upset, you can steer your dollars towards those local type producers who are really growing a lot. There's a lot of entrepreneurial energy there. But secondly, the problems here are antitrust problems and need to be addressed in the same way we dealt with the Standard Oil Trust 100 years ago and the Meat Trust. A public policy response is required.
Well, I'm assuming that they have very good lobbyists who are protecting themselves from that kind of legislation.
and have for decades. These lobbyists for different types of meat work hand in glove with one another to beat back any efforts at reform.
We saw what happened with Oprah some years ago when she was critical of the way cattle were being dealt with. She was sued by the Cattlemen's Association, mm-hmm,
That's right.
So am I in serious trouble right now?
It's a little late to inform you, but I'm sorry. I think you might be. No, I mean, these companies have to balance a fine line between attacking, intimidating, and just sort of trying to not engage.
Has anybody proposed any laws to change the situation? Have we seen laws in Congress, I'm assuming, that all just died?
Absolutely. I mean, people have been warning about this and trying to address it for decades. Tom Harkin out of Iowa, that senator, has been proposing laws that would just bring a modicum of transparency and competition to this market. I mean, not radical stuff here, but for some reason, the meat lobby really gets these ears in Congress and has killed this stuff for decades.
I've been interested in the response to this book, which is generally surprise. Should we be surprised?
Well,
I've been hearing about all of this stuff piecemeal over the years, but I guess you're the one who's finally put it all together.
First of all, I think people care a lot more about food today than they did back in the late 90s when I started writing about this stuff. But secondly, it is this issue that these transformations are happening in really remote areas, and people just are not aware of it. And frankly, I think the financial press hasn't done the job it should of getting reporters out to places like this.
And some people blame consumers for the same way that they blame people who go to Walmart and insist on lower and lower prices and then are shocked that those lower prices come at a price.
You know, I can somewhat relate to that. Consumers need to be aware of things. But at the same time, 100 years ago, we weren't blaming oil consumers for what Standard Oil was doing. And we weren't asking oil consumers to buy from the local mom and pop oil people. I mean, it's not necessarily consumers' fault that we've let consolidation go to such high levels, which is largely a public policy issue.
Have you heard back from the industry?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean,
and what are they saying? You got it all wrong?
Yeah. And it's funny. I think the main thing they're hitting me with is they're calling me nostalgic. They're saying, I want to turn back the clock. And, well, I'll tell you what, I don't want to turn it back too far to 100 years ago when we had a meat trust exploiting farmers and consumers. But what I point out in the book is that we got this right. Solving these problems is not rocket science. We had a transparent and competitive meat industry in the 70s, but we did away with it, and we can get there again.
Well, the other people who would complain are the ones who are saying you're being elitist. This is keeping food costs down for an awful lot of people.
Well, I suppose that'd be accurate if companies like Tyson weren't raising food prices sometimes by double-digit increases quarter to quarter.
Meanwhile, there is this book with a lot of startling stories. We didn't get to some of the personal stories that are quite moving in many cases. The book is called The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business. It is published by Simon & Schuster, and it has been my great pleasure to talk with Christopher Leonard today. Thank you so much for coming on our show.
Thanks a lot for the time. I appreciate it.